Hello, friends. Welcome to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today, we are joined by a couple of distinguished experts in criminal justice to talk about the death penalty. Joining us today, Major Kathy Fontenot. Ms. Fontenot was born in Metairie, high school in Lafayette, Como, go Spartans. Went to college at USL back in the day, majoring in criminal justice. She was on the homecoming court as well. She started working for the Louisiana Department of Public Safety and went all the way up to assistant warden at Angola. Then she came over and worked with Sheriff Garber as warden, and now she's back at East Baton Rouge as assistant warden over there. She retains the rank of major. We're also joined by Dr. David Kay. He's been on the UL faculty since 2015. He is the department head of criminal justice. He came from Loyola in New Orleans. His area of expertise are drugs and pharmacology. He teaches classes on crime theory and methods and research and so on. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Me too.
We are happy to have you. So let's talk about the death penalty. It's coming back. In the Louisiana legislature, we had some bills introduced on the subject of the death penalty. There have been all kinds of issues. We haven't executed very many people recently. The last time is 2010. There are dozens of people on death row, though, in Angola, a place you know very well, Major. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with this diminishment in the death penalty, and what does it reflect, if anything?
Well, it's dying. Pun intended. I arrived there in 1995, just to give you a little bit of perspective on how quickly the numbers are changing. There had 48 men on death row at that time. Eventually, we had our first female in many, many, many years, Antoinette Frank, who's still on the row. Today's numbers are 67 males, one female. However, in 2000, we had reached 99 men on death row, causing us to have to build a new death row, a more secure facility, because we had a escape from that area in 99, then discovered that the bars needed some attention. We built a new facility, opened up in 2007, and we started seeing, actually, after that time, that the death row population actually started diminishing for a number of reasons.
But executions wasn't one of them.
We actually executed up until 2010. We actually saw, I was there during seven executions from, 1995 to 2015. So.
Why don't we ask about that, if you don't mind? Mm-hmm. What's it like in terms of being involved in an actual execution? Is it on the participants, on the families, on the things? We've all seen movie treatments of this, and I don't know how true to life they are, but what's your perception?
We actually, the movie Monsters Ball, if you watch it, Halle Berry, P. Diddy is actually executed in the scene. We actually helped them change a part of that scene because they wanted to get it more realistic. Of course, we temporarily replaced the lethal injection table with the electric chair that sits at the Angola Museum on display.
Old Sparky, right?
Gruesome Gertie, actually.
Gruesome Gertie.
Yeah, Old Sparky is Florida.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That's Dave's territory.
Common
mistake,
what?
Though.
Gruesome what?
Gruesome Gertie.
Oh, God.
Is the name.
Okay.
However, so that movie sort of gets close to what an electrocution was. Of course, we haven't done that in many, many years. I would say it's a surreal thing because it doesn't happen very often for people. As a practitioner, you get to know the people on death row. You get to know their families. And you also, over the years, get to know the victims. And it's very difficult for victims, I can tell you. It's never exactly what they want. A common word that's thrown about there, and I don't like to use common words because I think a victim has their voice and it's what they want to say, but this idea of closure, it's very final for the victim in that memory of that loved one. It sort of gives fame to the inmate. We're worried about his last words. We're worried about what he's eating. The victim has to relive the trauma of losing the person through a very sterile, not about the person. It's about this person who changed your life forever. So it's very, as a practitioner, serving the public, but also having the responsibility to have custody and care over an inmate, those things clash at an execution. The whole security and safety of everything, and also it's a process that has to be done timely because it's a lawful execution of a person. So a lot of people don't, you know, we gave a lot of tours, for example, and they were like, well, why do you care if they're going to commit suicide on death row if that's their sentence? Well, because that's not a lawful way for the jury of your peers said that you were going to die this way. And it's very accurate to the time and the date. And it's just a and so as a practitioner, you're going through the steps of this. And then as a human being later, you're thinking about, oh, wow, that was an unusual thing that most people don't get to experience on many, many levels, jumping from the victim's family and their needs, the legal staff coming in their needs, the actual inmate, his family's needs, keeping all that in this area that runs by rules. It lasts with you a while. It makes a definite impression on you, as well as the other, you know, 5,100 inmates that are there, that all of a sudden your attention is this one inmate. So
it strikes me that as you add detail and complexity to the whole event, it strikes me that the people at Angola and who are participating in this event as it moves forward and moves through the process have a very nuanced and detailed view of the death penalty in a way that we kind of don't out in the public. You know, with us, there are all these kind of like, yeah, justice and retribution and, you know, what a dog. And there's this kind of it's more black and white out here. What you're describing is a lot different.
Mm-hmm. I actually have people that are practitioners that come and talk to my death penalty class, and I appreciate Dr. K for letting me do this class because I want to show corrections professionals, despite how you personally feel about some, if it's the law and you're in the enforcement business, you have to do that professionally, and you can also do that compassionately, though. You can be creative in ways that we couldn't be creative in before and really care for everyone involved. And that kind of raises the morale of people in my profession, which is actually not a very – that's not very well known, but it's also – we're sort of considered the bottom of the barrel when really we do a lot of things that really impact society more so than people would think.
Interesting. David, you want to jump in on some of this? Or?
Well, it's – just to put it into context – over the last decade or so, you know, the United States has been executing at a rate about 20-ish per any given year. And four countries alone represent the vast majority of executions around the world, and we're not one of them. We're still in the top 10, but there's other countries around the world that use the death penalty in executions at a far larger rate than we do. So while we're still an outlier in the United States, our appetite for processing these cases is becoming less and less, and we are looking towards applying it towards the most severe problematic cases, generally speaking. So the landscape is just changing so rapidly. Major Fontenot and I were just talking about, you know, just, you know, looking at the research right now and getting freshened up for the show, and it's just – it can change, you know, from month to month. Right now we have 25 states, all the states in the Deep South engage in death penalty cases still, even though they may not actively execute. They're still putting people on death rows. There's four states that are on moratorium. So basically we have half of the country engaging it. The federal government's moving back to try to get re-engaged. So there's more momentum to start re-engaging the death penalty. So it's definitely in flux. There's some headwinds that suggest that it's going away, but there's other headwinds trying to, you know, clutch it back into the mainstream.
Interesting. Is the death penalty a deterrent in your view? Is there an argument that you could make there?
I couldn't. All the science suggests that it's points to a moral stance of how we want to dole out justice in the country. For everything that we have, you know, scientific at our fingertips, all the tools suggest that there's absolutely not any deterrent factor at all for, you know, even life without parole. A lot of these cases have no, you know, deep thoughts behind, you know, wanting to think about those far-reaching consequences that may or may not happen. And in other countries where that's absolute, even if you're suspected of doing treacherous things like Saudi Arabia and other kinds of countries that have a very closed system, that's very different. But, you know, in our society, we just don't have that amount of control over someone's punishment. So there's a lot of variance out there that clouds people's judgment, but they don't even think two steps that deep, let alone all the consequences that could have happened years down the line.
Interesting. You know, recently in Lafayette, there was a 13-year-old and a 14-year-old boy who were convicted of – or not convicted. They were charged with shooting an 18-year-old student, I think, sitting in his car. And I was thinking about, you know, the death penalty and life in prison and those kinds of things in the context of those 13- and 14-year-old boy. What would you say to something like that?
Well, first of all, actually, he was a member of the Como football team, so right. I read that story and I was very saddened by it, obviously. It's just the whole situation. While I was a warden at Angola, we had eight inmates that were not 18 when they committed their murder. One guy was 8 days shy of being 18. He killed an LSU student, really popular case over there. They were automatically given life sentences. That's part of that reduction from the 99 that we had in the very few years. A lot of things changed nationally that made an impact on our death row. That was probably a really big one at that time. So Louisiana historically has treated juveniles as adults when it comes to cases like you described. And I mean, it's that whole, you know, this really hurts us right now, and we're going to legislate something that's going to do it. Much like Dr. Kay says, though, it's not the deterrent that it should be. It should be a general deterrent. That's why we had executions in the square. It should tell us all that a jury of your peers could put you in this position and you could be sacrificed your life if you killed someone. That doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. You know, it's almost like winning the lottery. It's not really going to happen. And the people that are doing it and the judges sort of have hands tied because the only sentence they can give you is life. It's not like a 20 years to life in other states, even amongst Americans. So this whole idea of if you murder somebody, you're going to get the death sentence is you probably go to prison, we think, but you don't think you're going to get the death sentence. And oddly enough, I interviewed a lot of people on death row. Half of them were for it. Half of them were against it. It depended on where they were in their case with what they would tell you. But they would be like, yeah, if you killed my mom or my sister, yeah, I would, you know. I had a guy tell me, I killed a man. I deserve to be in prison for the rest of my life. But they're not really thinking about that when they're committing the types of murders that match that sentence. Second-degree murder, for example. You're not thinking ahead. That's an act of passion. You could very well easily end up on death row and 5 years later get it reduced to life, which happens a lot in Louisiana.
Interesting. Well, we're talking right now with Dr. David Kay and Major Kathy Fontenot about the death penalty and criminal justice in Louisiana. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll talk some more when we come back.
Have you ever heard a story that changed the way you saw the world?
I had witnessed the terrifying joy of unbearable responsibility.
We fight for identity. Sometimes we kill for identity. But why is that?
I can't let my life be this. Because if I give up right now, that's what my life will be.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for inspiring stories on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Wednesday night at 8 here on KRVS.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through KRVS program sponsorship. For more information, call 337-482-1437 and thank you.
Hello and welcome back to Bayou to Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today we are joined by Dr. David Kay and Major Kathy Fontenot. And we have been talking about executions and about the death penalty. You last said that it's like winning the lottery. It's not going to happen, Major Fontenot. So what did you mean by that?
Well, the death penalty should be a general deterrent, but we know it's only a specific deterrent if you successfully execute that one person. You know for sure they're not going to kill again. It doesn't send the message that you should not kill because you could lose your freedom or your life. It's just too out there. It's too rarely used. And like I said, I think also we want a criminal justice system and definitely punishment that we can stomach as a, and we should. But, and that's why I think, you know, lethal injection is one of the most humane versions of it. You don't have all the excitement of a gas chamber or an electric chair. But it just doesn't shock the conscience of a would-be murderer.
Yeah, so the idea that at some point, what's the average length of time that people are on death row? I mean, are we talking 20, 25 years or something before the executions actually?
Yes, nationally, but Louisiana is so interesting because we have 64 different political parishes that are chiming in on these things. And what's interesting, and I thought about my research, was we looked at executions in the summer of 1987, the summer, 3 months, we executed 8 people in Louisiana. So when you go back and look at us, we were like, it was just brought back, and these sentences were, because what happened was during the moratorium, before we had our legislation reapproved for the death penalty, or our statute, because like everyone else, we were by the federal statute before, you know, that. And what happened was we started executing people using it because we still had people on death row. We just didn't have a way to execute them. We did not ever stop sentencing people to death. We're not uncommon in that. So
so let me get this straight. Now, when Furman – it was Furman versus Georgia, yep. I think, 1972 or 3. And death penalty was called off for a period of about 4 years until Gregg versus Georgia, I think, right, in 76. So what happened to the people that were on death row in Louisiana during that period?
The people that were on it at the time of the sentence were reassigned to life. But there were people being tried for first-degree murder that were being given the death penalty. It was just they had no way to execute them. So we had about 12 people that were on the row during that period of time.
And
I didn't know that until
that seems slightly arbitrary, you know.
And it was happening everywhere. Like you had zero executions, I think, in the 60s and 70s. But you had a growing inmate population. We've never had zero on death row in our country since the 30s. So it's kind of interesting that, like I said, we were just trying to find a way to make it more legal. It wasn't that the Supreme Court didn't say you couldn't do it. They just said, we don't like the way you're doing it. Let's all come up with our own ways. In saying that, getting back to your original question of how much time, Antonio James was executed in 1996, the year after I got there. He had spent 14 years on death row, which was the longest at that period of time that somebody had spent on death row in the nation. He was also the most reviewed case, which as a practitioner and learning about this firsthand in the position that I was in, I felt sort of good about. We were a state that was going to use all its appeals. That gave me, you know, it made me feel better about it if we had to do it.
Despite that, if I can jump in, I think Louisiana has the most cases exonerated 1900 to current in terms of we've had 11 people exonerated who were on death row who for whatever reason have been let out. So
correct, which to me, the system worked eventually. it's kind of like the chase team. You know, if they get out of our prison, we got the dogs to go get them. It's layers of, you know, we're humans. We err. You know,
well, wait a minute. We're humans. We err. Doesn't that indicate that there might be some second thoughts about the death penalty in general?
There is. And I think that's a big reason, you know, with DNA evidence, with the exonerations.
And one other thing that I want to introduce. Now, you have firsthand experience with death row. And so let me guess. I'm going to make a wild guess here. Your death row population largely middle upper class, white, well-educated.
Well, they're more.
So obviously, I'm being facetious.
Yes,
so
I'm
pointing
you.
To the kind of skewing that goes on. So could you respond to that?
Yeah, we definitely have people that are not very well educated, haven't gotten really far in school. More first degree murders than you'd think, though. First time offenders, but meaning of that, not first degree murders. They're all first degree murders, but first offenders.
So the first crime they committed was in fact their crime.
Well, the first time they're convicted of, for sure.
Okay. Good point.
Right. Now, there's a lot that aren't, but a lot that later get a reduction are going to be these horrendous things that happen, you know, especially if you're talking about the death of a child. We were talking earlier about people who rape and kill children. A lot of those have been let off because of the complexities of their trial, and there's always something that goes a little wrong. And if it goes a little wrong, they get a life sentence. I truly believe that it has to be 100% on this, and I'm really glad about the unanimous jury decision in our state, which is a whole different topic. But remind me a little bit about.
Let's switch to a slightly different question. Like, one of the reasons that we're not executing people right now is because we don't have the drugs. Is that right?
Correct.
Now, I know this falls into kind of you're a pharmacology person. So can you fill us in a little bit about that?
It's a lot about access. So the vast majority of states have turned to compound pharmacies to generate the products. And a lot of these substances that are being utilized are, you know, very old substances that are probably not the best in our pharmacology, in our pharmacopoeia, to engage in lethal injections and getting a means to an end of going through the process of an execution. So you're having, you know, battles between an industry that does not want to engage this process versus, you know, there's a lot of jurisdictions now are coming on board with euthanasia. And there's a lot more access and success for euthanasia programs, but relative to death penalty programs, which should have, you would think, the same sort of protocol, but they're becoming so farly different because of just access issues and the politicalization of executions versus compassion, even though it's really, you know, the same thing if you think of it,
so
but for very different means.
You're telling me that drug companies will make drugs for euthanasia programs?
Well, that's the trick.
But they won't make it for death penalty programs?
It's up to certain small compounding pharmacies that are scattered throughout the world that are creating the vast majority of execution drugs. And they're becoming less and less because of the fallout potentially of what could happen if their names were to be put on blast because they engage in this sort of profiteering, so to speak, off of death. But again, you know, if you look at euthanasia versus execution, you're pretty much engaging in the same thing.
Major?
Correct. Well, what's interesting about as a nation and just as people in general, when we talk about Europe and why they went against it, it was after World War II, mm-hmm. when state sentenced death meant the Jews and the execution of the state sanctioned. And you had a similar drop of support in our country. We didn't go as far as to get rid of the death penalty because I think we always like the comfort of knowing it's there. Like, I think that's where we are in our state.
Right.
I think if we used it more with the new support that's coming in to get away with it, it would pass quicker. But because we don't use it, and it's such a personal thing. I actually, before this, asked a bunch of people in various places that I've run across in this over the weekend how they felt about it. And many more now would not tell me how they personally felt about it. It's one of those topics that's sort of, I'm not for abortion, but I'm for this. And how can you be for both? It's a very, you know, we live in a very religious area, and I know we'll get to that later possibly, but it's just very interesting how people feel about it. But this whole idea of the state taking a life doesn't make it better that this – it's not the lesson you're trying to teach that person or others as a deterrent. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, you noted earlier – let's build on the region and the – we're in the South. And you noted earlier that I think going back to my notes, what was it? How many states – most of the states in the South have
– all of the states, in,
the states
deep
in the Deep South
engage out of 25 states overall that can – use the death penalty, at least put more people onto death rows. There's less that can engage in executions. They're still working through that. But all
the South
the
is
states,
also the religious kind of capital, yes, of the United States, a more religious region. People are more commonly go to church here and so on. What's the connection there?
That's, you know, deeply embedded in personal religious beliefs. Thou shalt not kill can be taken to that level of understanding that if you look at Hammurabi's code, if you look at the deep trenches of where our foundational religions come from, all of them have this embedded in it and what we should do to take one for the, a life for a life. It's equal, balance.
Life for life. Now, how does that work with Catholicism? We're in South Louisiana. There are lots of Catholics here, maybe some in this room.
Mm-hmm.
Pope Francis said that death penalty is unacceptable. It's into the catechism now. But, of course, also Catholics are very, very pro-life, very anti-abortion. So how does that work out? Can you be a good Catholic and support the death penalty?
I've had this conversation with Sister Helen, who wrote
Dead Man Walking. Of course, Dead Man Walking, one of the famous movies with Sean Penn as the protagonist.
And she said to me, she said, well, she signed her book to me, Choose Life. And she said to me one time, how can you participate in this? And you have all these beautiful flowers out front, because we did have really good horticulture at Angola. And you're killing people 6 miles inside the gate. That was tough. Personally, again, in the position that I'm in, I'm carrying out the law, and it's very tough. It's very tough to do that. And like I said, I'd rather it be a person like me that was thoughtful, compassionate to all sides, and professional in it than somebody who was gung-ho either way. It's really about moderation and balance, and I think that's our justice needs to be that. We need to hear the voices of the victims, though, and the reason that we're here is so that there's not a person out there scared, and like I said, that they should have a bigger voice in this. And I will tell you this, we started a victim offender dialogue program in Angola. The majority of the very, very worst of the cases were victims who, after many, many years, wanted to come and talk to that person about information. What was the last person my loved one said? What was that? And the fact that the person was still there to answer that question, you know, again, when you think about that person could have been executed before the victim had an opportunity to be empowered to ask that. So it's a tough topic.
It definitely is. Have you seen the movie Just Mercy?
Not yet.
I have not, but my guest speaker a few nights back is one of the 10 former incarcerated persons who go around promoting the movie. And I do know Brian Stevenson that it's based on. He's visited Angola many, many times.
Well, I certainly recommend it. And the book as well. It's a very interesting look at inside a justice miscarried. I mean, leaving aside the question of the suitability of the death penalty at any time, but the cases he focused on were ones where the defendants were poor, mostly minority, and had kind of been railroaded. There were serious problems. By the way, of the 11 people exonerated in Louisiana, all 11 had serious problems with the trial, with the testimony, with those kinds of things. So it wasn't as straightforward, perhaps, as it seems. Recently, both Terry Landry and Dan Clater got together, a Republican and Democrat, to introduce bills to abolish the death penalty. That was last session. They made some progress, but they didn't get over the top. Do you think the death penalty is around for a while in Louisiana, or is Louisiana going to change it?
Well, it would be very interesting to see that Louisiana would be the first deep South state to take that stride. You know, relative to our sister states in the Southeast, that would be pretty bold. You know, that would be very bold. Would it surprise me? I don't know, given our fiscal pressures. You know, expenditures for death penalty cases, capital cases, it can cost a bunch. In fact, that's probably one of the things that's really holding us back of reinvesting in our corrections and giving them the tools they need to really get to those populations for the rest of everybody who's trying to get out and reenter society, which is the vast majority of that population. If we had those funds, we could do a lot.
Well, John Bel Edwards has your position, which Major, where he says, I'm not going to say whether I support or not. I'll say I'll follow the law. Mm-hmm. So he might sign a bill if it got there. We've been talking this morning with Dr. David Kay and Major Kathy Fontenot about the death penalty in criminal justice. I'd like to say there is Criminal Justice Week at UL Lafayette going on right now. So if you find out about this event and are able to check it out, please do. In the meantime, thanks for coming to the show.
Happy to be here.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking about something that should be important to all of us. Mm-hmm.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
Get on your telephone and call somebody and tell them the Zydeco Stomp is on KRVS. Hi, I'm Herman Fuselier, inviting you to join me Saturdays from noon to 3 for the best in Zydeco blues and R&B on the Zydeco Stomp. You'll hear Gino Delafosse, Keith Frank, Travis Mott, Chris Ardwan, Bobby Blue Bland, B.B. King, Aretha Franklin, and you never know who may show up for the party. Barbecue and drink a few on the Zydeco Stomp from noon to 3 Saturdays only on KRVS 88.7 FM.
The University of Louisiana at Lafayette. This is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles, streaming online at krvs.org.